On this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
There's some of the most addictive substances that you can take, and we hear a lot about like the opiate epidemic. There's a benzodiazepine epidemic too that's really proliferative, trying to basically, you know, medicate my symptoms downstream and not get to what's going on with me, and taking the pharmaceutical route. That's where I ended up. Kava has this amazing balance that it captures a lot of the effects of a lot of these things while not knocking you off your center or compromising your faculties or your functionality.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever, but I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and your yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses. And keeping your mitochondria strong is one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam Beam, B-E-A-M, Beam Mineral Supplements, because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry. Throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. All right, folks. I know nootropics are a big thing these days. How can you get more focus and maybe better mood and social ability and, you know, often better creativity? And at the same time, I'm seeing, kind of like especially in the health industry, taking the world by storm, are all these ways that one could kind of get some of the stress relieving, social lubricating, even mildly like, you know, entheogenic or psychedelic effects that one might get from, let's say, like alcohol, without the debilitating effects or potential toxicity of said substance. You know, just like anybody else, I like me a good margarita every now and again. But let's face it, if there are other alternatives, then great. Now, I have one compound that I've been familiar with for quite some time. I used to go and race Ironman triathlons down on the island of Kona in Hawaii, and then after about 10 years of racing Ironmans down there, I started bow hunting in Hawaii. And every time I go to Hawaii, there's a little bar back behind the sand volleyball courts in Kailua Kona where I would go. It's called the Kanaka Kava. And Kanaka Kava is this place that not only serves you up like this wonderful Hawaiian beverage called kava, that's almost like this halfwayzy thing between like alcohol and weed that a lot of Hawaiians will use at night to relax. Got this really, really cool earthy taste. And they walk you through at this particular place, this special ceremony where you drink it out of a coconut, like an old coconut shell. It's got this earthy flavor to it. And then you like clap your hands and say some certain things. I forget. It's been a couple of years since I did it. And then you toss a little bit of it back behind you for good luck. And anyways, a whole ceremony behind this stuff, cause it's actually like an integral part of a South Pacific Islander type of diet or medicine protocol. And they also, of course, serve up wonderful like squid and pork and sweet potato and taro. And the place is pretty cool. If anybody gets a chance and you're in Kailua, you got to go hit up Kanaka Kava. But anyways, every time I've been in Hawaii, I have actually used kava. I love it. To help me get to sleep at night, to help me relax, kind of turns the mouth just a little bit numb, which is pretty interesting. And my wife and I once drove all the way across the island in Hawaii to another little town outside of Kailua called Hilo. And we went to like three different kava bars in Hilo because we were just like, oh, let's go try all the kava out here. And I remember both of us driving home, we were just chilled. It was like we'd been smoking weed all morning, but honestly, without a lot of like the couch lock, the appetite craving, some of the other stuff that goes along with weed. So anyways, I've been familiar with kava for quite some time. I've also been familiar with some of the issues people talk about regarding its potential for like liver toxicity and some other things that get brought up a lot. And so, a couple years ago, I met today's podcast guest, Cameron George. We were at a party at some kind of a health event, and he was there, and he was actually like behind the bar serving up these little like kava tinctures and kava drinks that he was making. And they were actually really interesting. It was kind of cool. It was like kava instead of alcohol. And since then, Cameron and I have gone back and forth because he keeps coming up with these cool like shots and cans and tinctures that he makes using kava. And about like 3 months ago, he sent me a batch of some of his latest stuff, and it just clicked with me. It was like, holy cow, this is actually a really, really cool product that I'll like use at night as a cocktail alternative, or even during the day if I'm a little bit amped up, or even if I like take too much of a substance like caffeine or some kind of other nootropic. It seems to kind of take the edge off of it, almost like something like L-theanine might. And so Cameron has a really cool story. I love his passion about this stuff, and it's actually super interesting. I think more people should know about this really interesting root, you know, plant-based elixir. So So Cameron, what do you think? Should we geek out on kava for a little while?
Yeah, always down for that.
Sweet. And you're in Arkansas right now, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Only one that I know of.
Freaking A. Yeah, you and what, the Clintons? That's about, yeah, exactly, of course, yeah. Me living up in Spokane, I don't run into a lot of, like, you know, people in our industry up here in Spokane. It's probably how I'm so productive, as I just don't have a lot of people to hang out with up here and don't get invited out to many parties or, you know, people who want to pick my brain and do coffee meetings. So I just, you know, sit at home and chat with folks like you and write books. So it works out.
No, I mean, yeah, I think we're pretty much in the same boat because, you know, I'm kind of in a, you know, a mountainous region locked here in the Ozark Mountains. It's beautiful. There's lots of amazing, you know, things to do out here. You know, there's fishing and hiking, and the Ozarks are a mountain range that a lot of people don't really know about as being this beautiful sort of landscape that's hidden down here in the South in Arkansas and Missouri. But it's a really amazing place. It's an amazing place to live, but I definitely get my privacy down here. And a lot of people ask me, wait, kava, Arkansas, what's the connection? Yeah. And it's totally serendipitous.
It's the secret to health in the fitness industry is move to a boring place that not many people know about, that's slightly rednecky, where nobody's going to ask you weird questions about health and you'll get a whole lot done, versus, like, you know, living in Venice Beach and having to go to Erewhon every day, or, you know, going to wherever else everybody's moving right now, Austin. So you have an interesting story, because from what I understand, you've told me a little bit about this. Like, you were, like, hooked on benzodiazepine and drugs and alcohol. And, like, I would love to hear a little bit more about your backstory, because I know it wound up with you actually kind of getting into kava as a way to save your ass. And it's kind of funny because I recently interviewed another guy who makes, like, he makes a drink that's like a combination of kava and kratom. His one's called Feel Free. Same thing with him. It was like the thing that saved his ass from drugs and alcohol was basically kava, to a certain extent kratom. And so it's kind of a story that I see repeatedly popping up. Someone kind of screws themselves over with pharmaceuticals and then winds up finding this natural plant-based alternative to rescue them from that. But what happened in your case?
Oh, totally, man. Yeah. And, you know, I think we're really kind of in the middle of what I call kind of a plant renaissance. And it's been going on for probably the last 8 to 10 years. You know, I mean, obviously all your listeners are really familiar with, you know, compounds like CBD and, you know, hemp, cannabis, all that. And that's sort of gotten its sort of second wind as sort of like all of this research has come out and it's sort of become like the darling of the industry. And there's some issues with that, but, you know, that's exploding. Now we're seeing research come out, you know, with psilocybin and moving towards, you know, medical legalization in multiple states and even, you know, recreational eventually possibly. And obviously, you know, there's ketamine therapy. So we're really kind of having this sort of rediscovery of some of these ancient principles and strategies in these plant medicines, and understanding that they have a broad spectrum of intelligence as a living organism that is not present in some of these isolated synthetic compounds that have their use in acute circumstances, but have their problems with addiction driving the body out of balance. And benzodiazepines are certainly in that category of something that has its place. But I mean, pretty much any, you know, psychiatrist knows, anyone who has worked with these medications, you know, substantially knows that they're some of the most addictive substances that you can take. And we hear a lot about, like, the opiate epidemic. There's a benzodiazepine epidemic too. That's really proliferative. So
yeah, and for people not familiar, that'll be like Valium, right?
Xanax,
or diazepam. Yeah. I mean, I used to, honestly, like, I used to have a prescription for Valium back when, speaking of Ironman triathlon, when I'd race Ironman, for two reasons. A, I'd a lot of times have, like, super long haul flights. And this was before I adopted the trick that I use now, which is just, like, basically take a 40 to 50 milligram edible bomb of THC and pass out in the plane. You wake up feeling a lot better than you do after Valium or benzodiazepines. But I would use it for long haul flights to help me to sleep when I was, like, going to a race. And then I would also use it, like, the night after I've had, like, these big competitions where you're sucking down glucose and caffeine and energy drinks and stimulants all day, racing for, like, 10 hours in the hot sun. And you finish up and you just, like, you'd think you'd pass out and be in, like, a coma after something like that. And your body's just completely wired up. And so I'd always have, like, a Valium on hand just so I could sleep and be able to get on the plane the next day or whatever. But, man, so many side effects, like, you know, constipation and, like, drowsiness, the addictive potential. But yeah, there was a time in my life where I kind of screwed around with benzos a little bit. I was never addicted to them, but I definitely got to experience some of the deleterious side effects.
Oh, totally. Anything that ends with an am is a benzodiazepine, like diazepam, clonazepam, alprazolam, lorazepam. That's Ativan, Xanax, Klonopin, Valium. Any of those, they're these anxiolytic substances that their main mechanistic sort of target are the GABA receptors, the GABA-A receptors specifically, which is like elicits, you know, this, you know, obviously the GABA pathway, which is the main brakes of the nervous system from a biochemical standpoint. And so that's why it has this huge sort of influx in the activity of that particular pathway, which calms down the cortisol, it calms down, you know, the glutamate response and all these excitatory neurotransmitters and stuff. So you know, those drugs are highly they call to a lot of people because we live in a very stressed, you know, traumatic time, obviously, from like every standpoint that you could possibly look at it. And so, you know, a lot of people just fall in love with them pretty quickly because it's sort of like an easy shortcut, but with any easy shortcut like that or alcohol, there's a very fine line between acute, like therapeutic app that has now sort of taken hold of you in a really negative way. And you know, the side effects, you know, the cognitive dysfunction that you can get, it muddles up your brain chemistry at the same time, right? Whenever you take high doses of benzos, it kind of suppresses your personality. And it can also lead to drowsiness the next day. And of course, like you said, like the constipation and a bunch of stuff. So, you know, they're very problematic for a lot of people. And there's a lot of people very addicted to them. And, you know, just like with my story, which I'll get into, the withdrawal symptoms from benzodiazepines can be so severe when you've been on them for an extended period of time that you can actually die from the withdrawals. I mean, they are some of the hardest drugs to get off of. You can have everything from seizures, you know, to even heart attacks and strokes during the withdrawal process on the severe end. It takes a lot of times like a year and a half to even do a slow, like, you know, taper, you know, from the drugs. So it's really bad. Those drugs are so.
Okay, cool. So you, well, not cool, sad, scary, but you were actually, help me to wrap my head around this. Like you were addicted to benzos, or what was going on with you?
Yeah. Okay. So with me, I mean, you know, I always give people kind of a truncated version of my story because it literally unfolded how I got into this over about 15 years. I kind of call it like a pain to purpose journey. A lot of us that end up in this industry have, you know, sort of this, you know, I guess you, some people call it like a wounded healer journey, or you get into it from a standpoint of like really having your back up against the wall. Right. And, you know, really being in a you know, pretty deleterious situation.
Yeah.
I can't imagine any normal scenario in which I would have just dove headfirst and niched out on this highly like specified route from the South Pacific and dove as deeply as I have over, you know, the past decade, had I not been forced into it from some sort of desperation, right? You know, from my standpoint, there's two primary ways that people grow, you know, and progress in their life. There's the inspiration path and there's the desperation path. The inspiration path's a lot more fun because you witness something that inspires you, like the death of a loved one or something, and it can inspire you to go down a certain path to learn and grow. And the desperation is like you have your back up against the wall. Someone is dying, and it forced you to go down it. But for me, you know, my situation, I became like horrifically sick with, you know, one of these sort of it's starting to become more explainable, but at the time, completely unexplainable sort of neurotoxic autoimmune syndrome illnesses, right? Where I just had a complete collapse of my health that I couldn't pinpoint to any one isolated diagnosis, right? It's always, you know, whenever you have these situations, especially in a young guy, because this happened to me when I was like 21. And I was a very high functioning person at the time, you know. I mean, you and I have some stuff in common because I was my life at that period totally revolved around endurance sports. I was an endurance athlete. I mean, that was I was you know, track cross country athlete at the University of Arkansas, and you know, Arkansas is like a track dynasty, so it's they've got like 42 national titles there, and so it was that consumed my whole life at that period of time, and that played into my process. But I was really high functioning, you know, I was working multiple jobs, you know, I was you know, a senior in college at the time, and I was running, I was racing. So I was running, you know, cross country in the fall. I was running indoors, you know, from January to March, and then outdoors, you know, from March to June. And then during the summer, I was racing marathons, you know, triathlons, and then even got into ultras. And, you know, during that period of time, I kind of had this, I came to this point where I started to get really fatigued and I wasn't recovering. And just like anyone in that world, you think, okay, I'm overtraining, I back off. I backed off, you know, nothing got better. And I ended up in the situation where I started becoming like overwhelmingly fatigued. It started to affect, obviously, you know, my training. I had to kind of step back. I was kind of unable to even like focus in class. I was just losing a lot of these basic functions and was starting to get very depressed and anxious and ended up on the couch, you know, and ended up being like incredibly, you know, have these, you know, ridiculous cravings for sugar and stuff just to keep me going and was like living on stimulants. So I ended up in the situation, not knowing much outside of, you know, from a biological standpoint, outside of what could give me like acute performance boosts at the time. I mean, I thought I knew a fair amount about the human body and how to get it to run faster, but I definitely didn't know anything from a longevity standpoint. You know, basically I ended up in a psychiatrist's office and I was prescribed a plethora of different drugs and, you know, medications, the primary one being an amphetamine-based drug called Adderall that most everyone is familiar with.
Yeah.
And that took me, you know, my situation from like, you know, chronically fatigued and I was in a bad situation that was headed to something worse, and it obliterated me. So I apparently had this perfect storm going on that we know now. And, you know, the perfect storm meaning it was a bunch of things that came together and just kind of exploded. I probably had susceptible genetics to, you know, not, you know, having, you know, some poor, you know, detoxification function and stuff, got exposed to a few toxins. I was in an apartment at the time that had black mold. I found out later some stachybotrys. I obviously got on the drugs. I was exposed to a lot of other things. I was eating like Taco Bell like four times a day, you know, as a college kid. So, you know, there was a lot of things that probably came together, but whenever I threw the drugs in the Adderall and, you know, even some of the benzodiazepines and some different things, it just totally changed my personality and it completely wrecked me, right? You know, the idea of like using Adderall to try to supplement your energy that's not there, it's sort of like, you know, writing hot checks with your body. It's not creating any more energy as a psychostimulant. It's just stealing from your deep stores. It's
right.
Borrowing from tomorrow to pay for today. And I learned that lesson the hard way. Basically, when I got on this, not only did it, you know, make me deteriorate physiologically, but mentally, it changed my personality. And I went on this crazy, I basically went into like a psychosis for like almost a year where my personality changed and my life went from being a high functioning person that was an athlete thing and, you know, working three jobs to I was living the life of a meth addict where I started doing all these crazy impulsive things and charging hundreds of thousands of dollars of like of money and credit. And I had, you know, businesses where I was flipping electronics. I worked at an electronics store and I was doing really obsessive, crazy things. And I ended up doing impulsive things like, you know, people always, you know, kind of laugh at this part of the story, but I like bought a bunch of exotic animals. I had an apartment full of exotic animals like monkeys and parrots and, you know, like a bunch of crazy stuff. And this was like something that was totally like a manifestation of like this amphetamine binge that I was on. Like I was like delusional from it. So anyways, long story short, my life deteriorated completely. I was connecting with all kinds of unhealthy people as well and ended up in some situations where I got all my money stolen from me by like drug addicts. I like, you know, it was like, like a total disaster. And my health completely collapsed because as I had all these animals, I was using a bunch of cleaning products and the, like, you know, the animal feces was like building up in my environment. It was like a complete nightmare. It was kind of like a crossover between Ace Ventura and Breaking Bad, like this apartment that I was living in. And so that's, it was truly stranger than fiction. Obviously, my life completely got obliterated. Not was I only like hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt by the end of this, but I completely lost my health. It completely crashed like at one point where the drugs weren't even working anymore and I had to get off them because my like family basically did an intervention on me, right? Once I got off the drugs, I became me again. I spent like 2 years being somebody else in this sort of amphetamine-fueled psychosis. And so it was literally like probably one of the worst outcomes a person could have with a drug like Adderall.
Yeah.
I tell that to kind of depict where my core philosophy of not only giving up my health to a third party totally, you know, which was like the psychiatrist and not sort of doing my own due diligence, getting multiple opinions, but, you know, trying to basically, you know, medicate my symptoms downstream and not get to what's going on with me and taking the pharmaceutical route, that's where I ended up. And so that gave me the framework that then I had all this healing to do. I basically was handicapped after all this. I had severe cognitive deficits that from all the neurotoxins and the Adderall. Man. I ended up getting a SPECT brain scan at one point, like they do at like the Amen clinic.
Right, right. That's like a blood flow scan for the brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I got one of those, and the radiologist, this was post Adderall, post all this, they were totally flabbergasted. They're like, I can't believe that you can talk as well as you can talk, because this scan is comparable to what I see in 80-year-olds with dementia, because they treat a lot of elderly people, you know, with dementia with hyperbarics where I was at. So yeah, it was crazy. So I basically started on this odyssey of trying to, you know, rebuild my health, rebuild my brain, my psyche, my neurological function. And also I was in a situation at that point that I was deteriorating, and I was kind of falling apart because I was just tanked metabolically, and I was becoming more toxic, and my gut was wrecked. And so it was just like this complete disaster, but it started me on this long, like 10-year sort of journey, where I basically did nothing for this entire time but scour medical and scientific literature, travel around, engaging in medical tourism, basically exhausting the rest of the allopathic model, medications and stuff just got worse, ended up in the functional medicine paradigm, just talking, you know, to doctors and researchers and scientists, and going in the country and abroad trying different therapies, and eventually got hooked up with some different networks of doctors. One, Dr. Dan Pompa, who you've had on the show, who's, you know, one of my closest friends now, who really helped me to sort of put, you know, together and assimilate a lot of these pieces that I had already sort of found into kind of a systematic plan, not only for detoxification, which really helped a lot, but also to kind of, you know, approach this from sort of a, you know, fix the cell to get well, approach it at its base. And, you know, so that was how I eventually got my life back, through combination of ancient healing strategies, detoxification, and all these different things with the microbiome and stuff, fasting. But then also layering in these modern day technological strategies like stem cells and peptides and hyperbarics and PEMF and different things like that. But how Kava came into it, though, was in the middle of this process, I had deteriorated to a point, and actually it was right after I met Dr. Pompa.
And by the way, I should mention, for those of you not familiar with Dr. Pompa, I've interviewed him a few times, and the show notes for the show you're listening to right now are at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Kava podcast, K-A-V-A podcast, and I'll link to my interview with Pompa. Now, I think it was actually at one of his events where I met you, now that I recall.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, we were there, and it was at the Kava bar there in Vegas, and yeah, one of those. So right kind of smack dab in the middle of this process, I was several years into it, and I was pretty much at my lowest point whenever Dr. Pompa and I met. I, you know, we were introduced through you know, someone, and I had reached out, and we got to talking, and he had taken on a lot of extremely complicated, like, neurotoxic cases. And it was, you know, a really bad situation, because I was at a point where I had developed this kind of sensitivity spectrum syndrome as a byproduct of this autoimmunity. And this is becoming increasingly common today, where you have people that are basically in a form of PTSD, a spectrum of PTSD, where they're so neurotoxic, liver toxic, their guts are so wrecked, they have such systemic autoimmunity that they start to develop primed both nervous system and immune system reactions to a host of things in their environment as part of the body's process of trying to protect itself from being so traumatized and essentially confused, and the gut being leaky and a bunch of this stuff. So I started developing severe reactions to obviously medications, but like supplements and even foods, and got to the point where I was reacting to almost everything that I was eating. And they started kind of mild, but then ended up in a situation by the time I got hooked up with him where I was having seizures from almost everything that I was eating. Like, I would eat a food and I would go into a full grandma seizure, or I would go into anaphylaxis. I would have different reactions, you know, based on different things.
Oh,
and I got to a point where it just became absolutely terrifying. Not only could I not think, and I was having trouble functioning and stuff, and I had to move back in with my parents and couldn't walk at one point. I even got to the point right whenever Dr. Pompa and I met, where I even started reacting to water, which I didn't even know was possible. Meaning, like, literally, I was in this clinic in Dallas, Texas, that was basically like a hub, basically, for some of the most chemically and environmental intensive people in the world, autoimmune diseases. It's called the Environmental Health Center, and people come there from all over the world, and they're basically quarantined. I had to be quarantined because if I got exposure to like certain things, like even like fragrances that people would wear, or like just chemicals, cleaning products, I even got a whiff of some of that stuff, I could go into a seizure. And it became so maddening that like I had to be quarantined in like these tile rooms, and I had to wear masks and stuff, which is kind of funny because that was like I was like everyone in this community was wearing masks and was quarantined back before, you know, the world was like years before that.
You got your practice early.
Yeah, exactly. But I ended up in this situation and, you know, for whatever reason, I got to a point where I would literally, you know, we had bought every water, like bottled water on the market and was like trying all these and some I would react worse to than others. Different mineral composition. I don't know, but I got to where I could put a drop of water on my tongue and I'd go into a seizure. And this is just something that completely blew my mind. I had no idea that that would even be possible. I was so reactive to almost everything. And so it was just this crazy situation. And so obviously that became dangerous. And, you know, by the time he and I met, I ended up in this long forced dry fast where, you know, Dan basically told me, he's like, well, you have to fast, basically. And I had no choice to. And to fast could help to stabilize the situation and calm down the nervous system and stuff. And I did it. I ended up going multiple days without water and almost died from dehydration. And that's not something that you just recommend people do without medical supervision. But it was an extremely scary. I had, you know, delusions and hallucinations during that time. I even had, you know, like a near-death experience that was, you know, very similar to what I had experienced from like psychedelics at times. It was pretty crazy. That was my lowest point. But during that period of time, I was having such violent convulsions that I was put on these heavy doses of benzos, right? So Xanax and Klonopin were the two that I was put on to try to control them. And I was even reacting to them. So I was like reacting to the drug, but then it would kick in and that GABAergic effect would sort of, you know, at least reduce them.
GABAergic effect, just for people who and you might hear that term thrown around a couple of times in relation to kava, gamma-aminobutyric acid, like an inhibitory neurotransmitter. Same thing that gets released when you, like, have a nice glass of wine or take, you know, there's some GABA precursors like passion flower extract or lavender and things like that can increase GABA. But GABAergic, that's basically what you're referring to when you throw in that term, right, Cameron?
Absolutely, yeah. This you just kind of think whenever you think GABA or GABAergic, you just think like calm, the brakes of the nervous system, basically things that just sort of pump the brakes, allow you to relax or shut down an excitatory response like that's going on in a seizure. And seizures are primarily driven by the neurochemical pathway glutamate or these NMDA-like receptors that are like the most excitatory. They're like the equal opposite to the GABA, right? You've got GABA and glutamate, and that balance is very fine-tuned by the intelligence of the body. And whenever it gets you get favored in a sympathetic mode from stress and trauma and neurotoxicity, you start to get this over-erratic expression of glutamate that damages the system basically through a process called excitotoxicity. But anyway, so I ended up in this situation where I was having seizures from everything, and I was on these benzos. And the problem was, is I knew this because I'd been down this road with Adderall. I knew that this was a very dangerous situation because I was so fragile that if my seizures got any worse, they were going to become lethal. And they already were very close. I was going to them multiple times a day, just getting weaker. I knew that, you know, benzos elicit tolerance, you know, relatively quickly. And if I kept using the benzos, eventually they were going to lose their effectiveness. And then I was going to ricochet in the opposite direction. My seizures were just going to explode. Because again, you're not creating any more GABA, you know, with these compounds. You're basically just using up your stores and expressions, and you're getting a down regulation. The body says, oh, this is unnatural. We've got too much of it. We're going to go in the opposite way, and that's a problem, a huge problem. And so I was in this situation where I actually started working with Dan as a client, and you know, we both were talking through this and just saying, I can't do any of the strategies. I can't do the detoxification. I can't do the fasting. I can't do anything unless I can get these reactions under control. And so I've got to find a way off of Klonopin, and my life depended on it. I had a very short window of time for this. And good thing I had already delved into all this for years and delved into the ethnobotanical world. And so I had like a good sort of database of information to draw from. So I went back to the scientific literature and I'm like looking, okay, I need a plant-based or natural analog or an alternative that could bind to those same receptors to kind of prop them up to allow me to safely transition off of these benzos and hopefully keep these seizures under control. I honestly, I didn't think I was going to find it because I didn't think I'd find anything in the plant kingdom that would really meet that power. Obviously, you named, you know, some of the more subtle compounds, valerian root, passion flower, lemon balm, you know, and even, you know, even taking straight GABA or theanine or taurine or magnesium. All of those things affect that pathway. But all of those things in the situation I was in was a little bit like trying to shoot a BB gun at a freight train, you know. Those things are great, but I was so out of balance. I was withdrawing from this drug. It just wasn't enough. So I was looking, and obviously I had come across kava before, and I had tried what I thought was kava, you know, multiple times from multiple different supplement suppliers, even, you know, sort of high level, you know, physician grade like formulas that had forms of kava in it under a form called kava kava, which is what most people who have heard of kava think of it as. But this term kava kava is actually not kava at all by definition, in the sense that from a South Pacific Islander standpoint where kava comes from, kava kava is an extract, and that's a name that was given to it in the United States, basically, and other places around the world, where they use solvents to extract it. They apply sort of modern extraction methodologies.
I get laughed at, maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever, but I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LeelaQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com.
I was commenting on the extraction technologies, because that's I think one of the big issues when we look at a lot of these like sacred medicines from around the world. It's pretty easy to bastardize them, especially using harsh solvents or extraction processes that can oxidize them. Or sometimes I know you wind up not getting the full spectrum of alkaloids in the plant, which can be difficult in the liver. But yeah, that I think that's a huge issue with a lot of these medicines is the processing and the extraction is just it's subpar.
It's massive. And for some plant compounds, plants, and fungi and all of these different, biological organisms are exactly that. They're living organisms. They're much more biochemically complex than a drug that's just one singular molecule that's isolated, usually ripped off from a plant or, synthesized from a plant. And it has one linear mechanism that pushes the body in a direction very powerfully. But these plants are living organisms like humans are living organisms that have hundreds, if not thousands, of active constituents that all work in sync and harmony. Like in each active constituent is like, say, like an instrument in a musical orchestra that you can isolate one instrument that, say, plays the melody, that sort of plays front and center, the most powerful ones. And you'll get effect, but if you have the entire orchestra, you'll get an experience that's much more full and has more depth to it and therapeutic value, right? Some medicines, though, extract better with solvents because they have, more of their overall effects comes from just a few compounds that you can extract with a solvent, and so you can get more of those therapeutic effects and not bring it too far out of balance. And there's a lot of herbs that extract okay, with ethanol. Kava is not one of those. You can use ethanol or other egregious solvents like acetone, which are like really bad. But kava is one of those that has a very, very unique composition that when it's extracted with solvents, you actually lose about somewhere between 80 and 90% of the depth of the overall effects profile. And so you end up with something that's just a small shade of what kava really is. And so that's why, by definition, all of these products that are called kava, virtually all of them are either one of two extraction methods. They're ethanol extraction methods or CO2 extraction methods.
Okay.
CO2 is a little bit better, but it's not. It does not capture the full array of active constituents in the plant. And kava very much relies on that entourage effect. So what I thought at the time, whenever I first sort of came across and I was in this dire situation, I thought, well, I've tried kava. It doesn't really do much. I'm not going to waste my time with it. Until I sort of reconnected right in the middle serendipitously with a friend of mine who I had met, who was a South Pacific indigenous islander who was from Vanuatu, which Vanuatu is like where kava's been used the longest. Its usage has been traced back 3,000 years. That's where most of the world's kava supply comes from. That's okay. Where our farms are and everything. But anyways, I asked him about this. He actually brought it up to me. He said, well, how come you haven't tried kava? I said, well, I have. I tried this. He's like, okay, what'd you try? I told him, and he kind of snickered. He laughed at me a little bit because he was like, that's not real kava, man. Like, that's kind of a joke to us.
And that was one of these like westernized extracts that had the extraction method you were alluding to. And I know a lot of these a lot of these kava products that are imported that you'll find in a lot of like health food stores, it says kava, like the capsules and the liquids and the pastes and the tea bags and everything you find. Because I started to look into this, like, you've got mold, you got mycotoxins, you got industrial chemicals, you've got a bunch of low grade varieties. I think you told me how a lot of them, and you kind of alluded to this just now, it's non-root aerial plant part, so you don't get all the different parts of the root. And I think that's why a lot of people have noticed nothing from kava. And then I don't want to totally derail your story. I want to get back to what this guy told you, but just because it's something that I get asked repeatedly, and again, I don't want to derail your story, but this is important, I think. What about the part about kava being bad for your liver? Like in terms of increasing liver enzymes or cases of liver toxicity, like that's probably the question I get the most about kava and one of the things people are most concerned about.
That's totally relevant because the situation with kava and proposed liver toxicity or, reported liver toxicity, was basically one of these issues that totally revolves around ignorance and misperception. And it's a context issue. So everything that we've been talking about, so far with kava and, the spectrum of quality and the spectrum of the effects, profile that you can get from everything from the kava solvent extracts with, toxic, plant aerial parts and solvent extracted and, mycotoxins, the whole thing, versus like your full spectrum drink elixir that's made through traditional preparations of only the root material that's been drank every day by 90% of the population of Fiji and Vanuatu for 3,000 years, with no reports ever in the anthropological accounts of deleterious effects on the liver or even on the body. It's seen as one of their most sacred medicinal substances that they use daily. They use certain strains daily. But anyways, this whole belief system around liver toxicity is something that if you Google kava or kava kava, it's starting to get better. You know, a lot of the work that we're doing and others, you know, it's starting to get better through Google, but you'll still find a huge number of articles of people who claim this proposed danger on kava and liver toxicity. Every one of these claims is all quoting the exact same source and the exact same origin of this particular story. And again, it was a context thing. So basically what has happened is back in 2001, there was a series of small studies that took place that was, you know, funded by one pharmaceutical company and in Germany and, you know, a couple in Switzerland. And, you know, at the time, kava was like at the precipice of a huge boom because people were really starting to realize like this was this sort of untapped, you know, commodity that could be as big as coffee, that it was like this, it was like this really amazing medicinal substance. And it was starting to be put in capsules. And of course, people didn't know how to deal with it. You know, Westerners were kind of doing their thing, not paying attention to the traditional preparations, trying to do what they do. And, you know, pharmaceutical companies were trying to do what they do as well, too. They were trying to create patentable forms of it. So they were trying to use aggressive extraction methods, you know, solvents and things to isolate what they considered the single compound or the series of single compound, the kava lactones as they're called. And so they were trying to make a patentable drug out of it. And it ended up in this series of studies that was carried out actually of all types of people on, you know, people recovering from alcohol addiction. So people already who had very compromised liver functions, high liver enzymes, and most people in these studies actually, when the investigation was gone back and sifted through, were on high doses of acetaminophen and other things as well too, that increased liver enzymes. So there are a few factors there, but you know, this is one of those things that has been, you know, fully unpacked and is really not even a dispute in the scientific community anymore. Even the WHO, you know, is a lot of times is behind on things, has taken a full position after reviewing all the scientific literature on this subject. And over the last 15 years, these series of studies has been fully unpacked. And it's the conclusion has been, you know, very clearly demonstrated that that it was completely a quality control issue. So what happened was is that this one pharmaceutical company was just looking for kava, and they were looking for kava lactone specifically, like a few of the actives. They're trying to isolate them, and they went and they didn't know what they were looking for as far as kava material. They didn't pay attention to traditional methodologies that the indigenous people have always utilized. They were looking for just kava material. They bought up some of the cheaper kava material they could find. Some unscrupulous large-scale farmers in the islands were selling them what we now know as aerial parts of the plant, so waste product that still contain kava lactones, because the full plant of kava contains kava lactones, right? But the indigenous people, since for the last 3,000 years, have only consumed the roots of the plant.
Right, and the aerial parts, from what I understand, even though they're less concentrated in a lot of the beneficial compounds, that's like less expensive for a manufacturer to actually harvest and sell. So it's kind of like, you know, it's almost like when you get an expensive supplement and you read that it has something really nice in it, like, I don't know, let's say NAD or something like that, but it says proprietary on it. They don't tell you amounts, and they're legally allowed to what in the industry is called fairy dust, like a very, very small amount of that into the product. Kind of reminds me when people are using like plant medicines like this and using just the aerial leaf parts of a similar type of problem.
Exactly. And you know, they're much cheaper because they're in the islands and in Vanuatu and Fiji and the other islands, they're considered waste product. So they'll sell, you know, unscrupulous farmers, which now there are much less of those than there were because, you know, smart farmers understand that's bad for the whole industry because it perpetuates negative reputation in this non-contextual type of discussion. But there's still a lot of people doing it where they'll sell their waste product for like very low costs and, you know, next to nothing. And they'll grind it up so you can't tell, because they'll grind it up with some root product. So it comes to you in just in this powder form, and you can't tell the difference unless you do a specific type of testing that we do called chlorophyll testing, where you can test to see if it has any of these aerial parts in it. And, you know, so basically this pharmaceutical company wasn't paying homage to either, you know, the source material, which okay, so the aerial parts, the reason why you're not supposed to consume them is because the roots are the underground portion of the plant. So they're not exposed to, you know, the deleterious attacks and effects of like, you know, animals trying to pick away at it and pests and things. The aerial parts over generations, obviously, of the kava's, of, you know, kava's lifespan as an organism in the South Pacific, it's developed these plant defense compounds in the aerial parts to defend itself from being attacked, right? And it plays a protective role in the environment. It's very protective. That's why it has protective effects. But the protective effects are at a degree and to a level and have certain chemical compounds that we see as these plant defense compounds. It's the same conversation that we see around like lectins and some of these things, except for these are very egregious alkaloids. There's one called pipermethystine that's in the leaves of kava that is essentially a mitochondrial toxin. It's not something that you're going to get a hormetic effect off of. It's something that it actually hasn't even been shown to be like.
It's called pipermethystine.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's important because I think like the actual name for kava is pipermethysticum. So that doesn't, like, if you see pipermethysticum, that just means it's kava. But what you're saying is if it's very concentrated in this pipermethystine, that could be problematic for the liver. And that's what you see in a lot of these these leaf extracts.
Yes, exactly. You know, and that alkaloid is only present in the leaves and in some of the stems. It's not present in the roots. So the roots are you know, below ground. So it has no, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, from an adaptable standpoint, it has no reason to, you know, develop these plant defense compounds for something that's – for a part of the plant that's underground because it's not being attacked. So, you know, so basically it has a vast array or the highest level of kava lactones and the active medicinal compounds in the plant, but it has none of these toxic alkaloids, and it has some of the certain strains, even of the roots, have some of these other compounds, these chalcones that actually are medicinal, but in high dose just can cause some side effects. That's why certain strains that are in a certain range of even these flavocavains that are in the roots are the ones that are considered adequate for daily use. And they're not toxic. They're actually medicinal. But you can get certain more wild strains that aren't for daily use, more acute medicinal use, that have high levels of these flavocavains, these chalcones, that are highly, highly medicinal, but in high doses, they can cause stomach upset and some things that people associate with high doses of kava that actually aren't a kava issue. They're more of a specific strain issue, but you definitely don't want the aerial parts. So there's a lot of context to understanding how to form a relationship with a plant, right? It's like certain plants have to be prepared in certain ways. There are certain plants like rhubarb that you can eat a certain part of the plant and make a pie, and the other part is toxic, right? There's trace amounts of cyanide-like compounds in apple seeds and different things people know about. And it's like – and there are plenty of – there are some, you know, mushrooms that you can take, and they'll help to modulate your immune system, like reishi and cordyceps and lion's mane. And there are some mushrooms you pick up off the ground, and they'll kill you in a half hour, right? These medicinal plants, it's you know, it's learning basically which ones you can form a relationship with and then how to facilitate that and which parts of the plant to use. And so this pharmaceutical company obviously wasn't taking any of that into account. They ended up purchasing a lot of aerial part material that also wasn't these daily use strains and things. Then on top of that, they applied acetone extraction, which not only do you get a percentage of acetone, this toxic solvent, in the final extraction, but you also get this isolation and this concentration. So these alkaloids like pipermethystine are like 10 times more soluble in ethanol and especially in acetone than they are in water, which is what the traditional extraction is. So then they ended up with something that by definition was not kava at all. It was a kava-like drug basically that was totally taken out of its natural context. It ended up, you know, listing only even like a couple dozen, two or three dozen, you know, cases of liver toxicity, a couple cases of liver failure, and people coming off alcohol. And so basically it was a disastrous situation that then got a bunch of media press. There may have even been, you know, some pharmaceutical, you know, tinkering of, there are people in this industry that truly believe that, you know, a few of these companies were trying to take a shot at kava. That may or may not be true. But anyways, it led to like countries being scared and just parroting this story over and over. And this entire belief system that spread around multiple countries, there were bans all over the place, was all stemmed from this one situation. That if you look at it from a you know, surface level standpoint, in Vanuatu, Fiji, in the South Pacific, the traditional preparation of the brew has been consumed by 90% of the population for 3,000 years as a regular food with no anthropological reports of this. And it's never been demonstrated that traditional kava has any deleterious effects on the liver. In fact, clinically, we've used it on hundreds of patients and seen improvements in liver function many times. So it's a very interesting thing of – it's very similar to what happened to tryptophan in the early 1990s, is just kind of one quick point on this point, that you know, back in the early 90s, tryptophan was banned because there was one group that basically synthesized – a version of it that wasn't chemically tryptophan that had neurotoxins in it because it was a quality control thing. And it hurt some people. Then the entire industry banned tryptophan in the United States for a period of time until they realized, oh, there's context here, right?
Right.
It was that thing. The WHO has taken a position on it after reviewing, you know, the literature. It's not even really a debate anymore. It's like, you know, telling this story about the difference between CBD and marijuana, right? There's a difference between kava extracts and traditional kava.
So basically, with the liver issues, what we're looking at is some pretty rare instances when individuals consume contaminated kava products like the toxic above ground aerial parts of the plant, these non-noble varieties or kava extracts that get denatured through solvent extraction. That's the biggest issue when it comes to kava. And you were talking with this guy. What was the name of the island you were on again?
Vanuatu.
Okay. So
Vanuatu is an island chain, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I interrupted you when you were talking about what this dude on Vanuatu was filling you in on when he told me he'd used kava and not noticed much. And what was he saying to you?
Yeah. So basically he was like, well, this is like an obvious try for you, you know, because like kava is like our most sacred substance. It's like this, you know, in its traditional form, it has like these entheogenic effects that are almost psychedelic. It's used as the core foundation of the social fabric of our country. It kind of holds the social fabric together. It's used for weddings, funerals, spiritual ceremonies, social gatherings. And I had read a lot about
it. Beer in America, but better.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, in the islands, they have kava bars. In Vanuatu and Fiji, they have 20 times as many kava bars as they have regular bars because they prefer the experience. They prefer the community atmosphere that it creates because it puts you in this kind of state of calm, enhanced focus where you're opened up. It kind of opens up the heart center. It has some of these, what I kind of alluded to as subtle psychedelic effects. I'm starting to call it like the sober psychedelic because it kind of gives you this background psychological sort of underpinning effect of like fully integrated systems thinking where you can kind of sort of, you get this sort of left-right brain hemisphere interaction or hypercommunication where it allows you to kind of like look at things from a more broad spectrum, big picture perspective like people experience with psychedelics where they can kind of zoom out and kind of like look at the circumstances in their life on a broad spectrum timeline and they can reflect on kind of the big picture instead of being in sort of a stress-induced beta state where you're kind of locked into what's right in front of you in this fight or flight, which that's where people kind of are their lowest animal self. This will put you in more of kind of like this alpha state that allows you to kind of relax and reflect and open up and have deep, authentic conversation with people. It just creates amazing environments, allows people to connect. It induces empathy amongst people.
Yeah, it reminds me of like a little more chill, laid-back version of like a microdose of psilocybin. And, you know, I've kind of been messing around because I know you're now producing like – you've got these shots. You've got even like a canned drink, which I love. That's like my favorite, and I don't think it's available yet, but you're working on it. You've been sending me some betas, and I absolutely love that. And then you've got like the tincture, and honestly, like sometimes – I have no clue if this is kosher or not, but I'll sometimes like if I'm at a restaurant and I don't want to order a cocktail, I always have a bottle of your tincture in my fanny pack now, and I'll literally just like order some bitters on ice with club soda, and I'll put a few dropperfuls of the kava in there, and it's basically like the same cocktail feel again with none of the acetaldehyde or alcohol based toxins or anything like that. So it's kind of like a way to squeeze in a cocktail at a restaurant without actually having an actual cocktail. It's super versatile stuff. I love like, but I also could have taken some like right before this podcast and been fine, you know, not feel like I've had a couple martinis or anything like that.
Absolutely. And that's one of the best things about it and why they prefer it and why there's 20 times more kava bars in these islands as there are regular bars is because it gives what most people are seeking from the alcohol experience without the drunkenness, addiction, deleterious effects, and kind of the suppression of human consciousness that you can get off of taking high doses of alcohol.
Which is why it's also kind of good for getting off of alcohol, you know, even if you just like, well, let's say you have two or three drinks in a day now and you want to cut yourself down to one, just like have one and then switch to kava. And I mean, it's remarkable as far as that goes, but there's like some other stuff that you were filling me in on with kava that goes beyond like the focus and you know, kind of like the mental clarity combined with the social lubrication effect that's similar to what you might get with, you know, alcohol combined with a nootropic or like a, you know, a plant-based psychedelic or something like that. For example, it's got some pretty good anti-inflammatory effects, kind of similar to CBD, right?
So kava is actually one of the most well-studied herbs, like, in the scientific literature. It's just one of those things that it continued to be aggressively studied to try to work out this enigma of why this claim of liver toxicity had come about. And outside of cannabis, ginseng, reishi mushroom, and a couple others, it has a pretty large body of literature around it that have looked at and established multiple mechanisms. And so basically what kava has been known for, or its signature from an energetic standpoint or from an organism standpoint in the natural ecology where it grows and where it's used, is kava is known as a protective substance. That's kind of like its identity, right? It plays a protective role in the natural ecology. And so therefore, its signature as a living organism, it's developed a broad spectrum of biochemical, adaptive processes that have led to, almost like a complete subset of biochemical, compounds and molecules that elicit adaptation and protection basically against all forms of stress. And so whenever you take this organism into your body and form a relationship with it, it transfers that adaptability to you from a biochemical standpoint, and you feel it almost feels almost like this biochemical shield that allows you to adapt to stress and reduces the limbic system and different things. But because it's a full, living organism, just like the human body's a living organism, it doesn't just hit on one neuroprotective mechanism. It seems to hit on almost every neuro and tissue protective mechanism that we know of to some degree, and some more than others, right? So the GABA effects are what it's most known for, because that's what gives you the illicit feeling, and so that, reduces glutamate levels and excitotoxicity, calms the limbic system, puts you in a parasympathetic state. It's very protective in that sense. But it also has effects on ion channels. So, sodium calcium channels, which is the same mechanism that anti-seizure drugs work on. It's in, obviously even, in discussions about, the possible deleterious effects of exposure to like electromagnetic radiation with Martin Paul's work and looking at the activation or influx in these calcium channels. You get this influx of calcium into the cell is part of kind of like the inflammatory toxic response that could be happening there and leading to hydroxyl free radical production and stuff. And it appears to definitely block this. And actually, I was EMF sensitive too during my process, and that was one thing that I noticed. I could tolerate a lot more exposure to things, and recover. But aside from that, so it helps to calm those systems down, and sort of calm the cell and calm the systems around it. It also is a COX-2 inhibitor, which is very similar, the same as non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, but without the toxic effects on the gut lining and the kidneys and things. And so we see a reduction in inflammation. It has, powerful hormetic effects on, NRF2, NRF2, which is the antioxidant response that stimulates kind of the production of glutathione and catalase and superoxide dismutase and those things. And so it has multiple neuro and tissue protective mechanisms, and then it also has really amazing metabolic effects too. It has effects, it's a really powerful AMPK activator. So, AMP kinase, it's basically, the fat burning cellular autophagy
really?
Pathway.
Okay. So there's like a little bit of like an anti-aging longevity component too, as far as cellular cleanup.
Yes, absolutely. It certainly appears so. And actually, some of the most exciting study around kava right now, and has been for the last while, and what in the scientific community, what it's most like looked at as far as excitement, even more than its neurosis, it's a nervous system effects, is the effects that it could have on the process of developing in managing cancer, because not only does it have this effect on really powerfully suppressing mTOR and activating AMPK and the cellular cleanup of senescent cells and things, but it also has selective apoptotic effects to senescent cells that can't adapt to these flavocavains that I mentioned earlier. So in the highly medicinal compounds of kava, these are actually seen in the scientific literature as like natural chemotherapy agents that actually control unnatural or unhealthy cell differentiation within a plant. And so you take those into your body, and it appears to have some of those effects. And there may even be powerful antiviral and antimicrobial effects from them as well too. So it has kind of this 1-2 punch, and there is there are studies that range across almost every form of cancer that we know of right now with these flavocavains isolated and with the combination of, kavalactone, one particularly called Yangonin, and these flavocavains as well, that has this 1-2 punch that kavalactone was shown to help to sensitize like bladder cancer cells against the apoptotic effects of the flavocavains, which then in an apoptotic mechanism. So
yeah,
it's very fascinating. And those mechanisms, I mention all that because that's another protective mechanism too. And so we see a pattern here of this recycle mode of the body, right? There's this kind of seesaw. Like you either go into this kind of recycle and, you know, repair would be like mTOR, right? You know, would be like growth or autophagy and stuff. Putting the body into this recycle mode is a protective mode that helps you survive during times where there's not food present, clears out bad cells that become harmful to you, toxins, and then the other detoxification and cell stabilizing effects. It's all neuroprotective.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You even told me about some recipe for accelerating the fat burning and autophagy pathways with kava. You were like mixing stuff in with it. I think you said you had like a little bit of coffee, the kava, and was it like C8 or MCT oil to amp up the effects?
That right there is an amazing, that's an amazing stack that a lot of people who we've done promotion podcasts and different things with have started to really take to.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna step it up a notch, because what I've found to work really well is if you go to like HVMN or Ketone Aid or any of these folks, they have like ketone esters. A shot of ketone esters with kava, and I've actually been throwing a little bit of kratom in there as well. That is just like for like hyper focused productivity in a relaxed state for a long period of time. That is an awesome combo. It's like the 3Ks, right? Works perfectly. Kava, kratom, and ketones. That's a really, really good stack if you haven't tried that before.
Yeah, exactly. And you can throw a little bit of – there's a lot. You can go all day with this stuff. I mean, you can throw – there's a similar story around another plant called kana that actually is really synergistic, you know, kava. But
I haven't used kana forever. So we sound like druggies. But yeah, kana is interesting. I've used that for plant medicine ceremonies before.
Well, yeah, and I don't want to go off the rails too much with that, but it basically is another one of these plants that is highly dependent on the source, and you can get really weak kana that doesn't do much, or you can get really strong kana that you can use in smoke blends, and it actually has some entheogenic effects that affect, you know, the serotonin pathway as well, and it also suppresses appetite, and it's a PDE4 inhibitor. Yeah. It can be a nootropic.
Kana reminds me a little bit of Salvia divinorum, kind of falls into that same category. Like either of those are pretty nice. Kana spelled two N's, right? It's Kanna, I believe.
Yeah. Kana Scelidium tortuosum. It's a South African plant. It's a flower that's been used even longer than kava, actually. And that one's another one of the up and comers that is sort of in this wheelhouse of like things you can use to taper off of antidepressants and other kind of, you know, compounds as well too. But like all these things, and you know, the kava MCT coffee combination is a really easy one that almost everyone has access to coffee and MCT now, especially like, you know, your listeners, of course. The good thing about that is not only do you get a sort of compounded fat burning sort of cellular autophagy effect and nootropic effect, but both MCT and caffeine also act as amplifiers or facilitators for the absorption of kava lactones into the brain. So MCT acts as kind of like this like lipid carrier, right? That can like sort of like, you know, push things. It's like, it's an amplifier. It's a facilitator. And caffeine, because of the effects it has on blood flow and things, you know, to the brain, that it's, you get a noticed increase in the euphoric hit that you get from kava when you mix caffeine with kava, for sure. Yeah. So those two things together are really, really nice and really, really good, you know, whenever used together. So the oil goes well, like in like a bulletproof style coffee, that caffeine MCT thing.
Right. Because of the GABA effects too, you know, a lot of times I'll recommend for people who wake up in the middle of the night and can't get back to sleep, like I've recommended like Quiksilver Scientific's LipoCalm as a GABA precursor, or even like a chamomile or a passion flower extract. Kava also falls in that category. Like if you have like your tincture works well for this, you can keep it on your bedside. And if you wake up at like 2 or 3 a.m. with ruminating thoughts and can't get back to sleep, you do a couple dropperfuls of that, hold it on the tongue for like 60 seconds. Seems to work pretty well because of that GABA component. And I haven't found kava to deleteriously impact sleep architecture at all. If anything, it seems to help it out quite a bit.
Tremendously. That's one of the things that it's best for and what we see in the studies. But also, I've gotten the opportunity through, you know, the network of doctors that I work with, you know, total work with, you know, several thousand around the country. And I've gotten, you know, the opportunity to see a lot of clinical observation, you know, and anecdotal accounts that, you know, too, just from things that haven't been looked at super thoroughly. We definitely see in our patient populations with the doctors that are using these products that we definitely consistently see, you know, improvements in both deep and REM sleep in a large percentage of people who take it. And it definitely, I've really never seen a case of it interrupting sleep unless someone has a bad reaction to it, which, you know, people could react to anything. It's one of those things that, unlike cannabis, definitely not CBD, but like marijuana or alcohol, that both can like knock you out, but then kind of screw up your sleep cycles if you measure it with an Oura ring or something. Mm-hmm. You know, kava has an amazing effect on sleep, and you'll actually get more vivid dreams a lot of times whenever you take high doses of kava because of because of the improvements in the in some of those cycles. So that's something that's really nice about Kava for sure.
Yeah. So you're basically taking Kava. Are you somehow sourcing it in a way that's getting rid of a lot of these issues that we discussed earlier? Like where do you actually get this stuff?
Well, and actually, here in a second, I can go back to the rest of the progression of my particular story.
Oh, yeah. But this we got to finish your story. I know we're getting long in the tooth. we don't have a ton of time, so I want to make sure you get a chance to finish that story.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all interwoven together, so it's all relevant and my experience to it and exactly how this stuff was demonstrated to me. But anyways, I spent about 7 or 8 years developing a supply chain and relationships in the South Pacific, with the indigenous people. And I felt like that I needed to, if I was going to do this, I mean, I became extremely inspired through my process to just, invest in full immersion into the context of this plant so that I understood it. I understood its particular role, not only in the environment, but, potentially in modern culture. I wanted to pay respect to the indigenous people that have helped to, facilitate the development of these strains of this plant. And, the origin sort of home, not only from an environmental, soil standpoint and everything where it comes from. I wanted to make sure that I was going to do this right and that we could produce product that we could scale to the masses, because I believe from the beginning that, eventually with, the work that us and others that are doing in this industry, that Kava can eventually become as common as a cup of coffee if the supply is scaled to the to the degree that it can be, because it's a commodity that really has some of the best effects of alcohol, coffee, and CBD wrapped into one, like we discussed. But so I've been developing this supply chain of that's scalable in mass for the last however many years here. Actually get a consistent standardized supply of a good combination, balanced combination, from an effects profile standpoint, of strains that we can produce at scale, that every batch is tested not only for biological but industrial contaminants. Everything is grown organically, although we don't have the organic certification yet because it's grown in Vanuatu. But everything is grown without the use of pesticides or anything, and everything is tested for mycotoxins and mold.
So you are growing it there in Vanuatu?
Yes.
Okay.
And so we've secured and developed harvesting and drying methods, as well too, that prevent mold growth. And we're even working on some in the future that'll take the potency up a notch, that we're looking at stabilizing fresh kava, which right now this is traditional kava, but it's traditional dried kava. Fresh kava is even more potent. Like if you pull out a plant like in Vanuatu and make it right there, and it still has all of the fresh active enzymes in it, even above all of the regular active constituents, it has a next level of immediacy that's undeniable, that can be to 5 times stronger and everything. Mm. So we're working on, a method fresh kava and a more premium product line that will be more as an alcohol alternative and less of a standard retail product. So there's multiple tiers to this of what we're working on, but the supply chain has been very, very, important. And I had to, we had to control every step of the process, and we had to have full transparency available at every step of the process, because it's so subject to contamination because of the strikes to Kava's reputation. If we were going to do this, we had to do it right. We've been working with regulatory agencies, WHO, Codex. There's an international quality standard that we're in a group sent a proposition for, or a proposal rather, that's set to be inducted this year into Codex that outlines this series of criteria. For Kava, for it to be classified as a food. If it meets these criteria, then we'll be able to get food classification just like coffee. And so we've done a lot of stuff with the regulatory agencies to create a framework to where we can help usher this into the modern world and into, American life in the most credible, transparent way, as possible, to protect it from any of the, of the negative misrepresentations, basically. So
yeah,
our sourcing is incredibly important in that sense.
Yeah. And I think what's kind of interesting too is the idea that with I've noticed this with yours, and it's kind of back to the whole issue with the psychedelic component, is this idea that I think you described it to me as like a systems-based thinking approach, that through the chemical pathways that Kava seems to be targeting, you get almost like this hyperconnectivity and communication that's enhanced between the left and right hemispheres of the brain. So like for creativity paired with productivity, like for me, because I've been doing a ton of writing, and for some reason, because this is like the second podcast I've done, I think, in the past couple of months about
kava, you know, it's just become like one of my go-tos, really. I absolutely love it for especially like long, deep work sessions or nighttime relaxation as alternative to cocktails. Like something about it just works. Just maybe it doesn't agree with everybody, but it seems to just shift me into this alpha state for maximum creativity and learning new information. And I don't know everything that's going on, you know, it's probably multifactorial, but I'm pretty stoked about my use of it, especially now that I know I can get access to a source that's not gonna be bad for my liver, for example.
For me, I always describe it like this. I've worked with almost every powerful and subtle plant medicine, you know, that's available. I mean, no one's worked with everything, but I've worked with a lot. I've worked with all of the heavy psychedelics, you know, all of the tryptamine-based psychedelics, you know, psilocybin, you know, the DMT-based compounds, LSD, all of those. And I've worked with all of the, you know, the standard adaptogens that have, you know, very subtle effects and that are more for the body, you know, less for the psyche and the spirit and the mind. Kava has this amazing balance that it captures a lot of the effects of a lot of these things while not knocking you off your center or compromising your faculties or your functionality, meaning that it kind of gives you it has, you know, probably the greatest therapeutic effect to drawback ratio of any medicinal plant that I've come across, meaning that there are some that are stronger, right? Like psilocybin mushrooms, high dosages will take you into a completely altered state, which has its time and place, but needs to be carefully, facilitated. And you can't use it every day in those dosages, of course. But, you know, kava is something that, you know, sometimes the best medicine is not the one that hits you over the head with a hammer, but it's something that can be taken regularly, that can be controlled, that can really be used and integrated into your life in a regular way. And right. Kava allows people to sort of grasp what they're trying to get from microdose, opening up the mind and allowing you to access more of who you really are as a person, and opening up the heart and allowing you to socialize, but without taking you into an altered state, compromising your faculties, making you drunk. And so it's this amazing alcohol without the drunkenness, but also elements of the entheogens. And so what we, and this is what I'm so excited about with kava, is that I see this as you know, much more of an important project than just supplying something that just relieves anxiety on the surface or something, which it does. And that's how, you know, a certain percentage of people understand it. But if we look at any culture from an anthropological standpoint, from a historical standpoint, you know, some of the highest values and inspirations of any given culture are largely contributed to by the altered states of consciousness that they use to you know, connect with each other and form the basis of their community and their perspectives, right? So and a lot of times that involves plant medicine rituals or other, you know, rituals. But it usually has some form of altered state induced by plant medicine. So some ancient cultures, indigenous cultures use more, you know, psychedelic-like compounds like ayahuasca as part of the core fabric of their culture. You know, some cultures like the West have embraced alcohol, and you see that reflected in the collective mind, the perspectives, the behaviors, because they help to shape how we look at reality, how we look at each other and connect with one another, because the quality of the time spent connecting with other people and with ourselves and reflection dictates the quality of how we develop as humans, right? And so, you know, when you talk about something like kava and possibly sort of integrating it into the culture, it could possibly have really a large scale positive net impact on the collective mind or perspective of the culture. Michael Pollan wrote a book. He was on Rogan's podcast not too long ago. He was talking about how coffee helped to shape the collective mind of the US like during.
Yeah, he has a really great like little short book on Amazon about, I think it's called like caffeine or something like that. But yeah, his writing on coffee is really interesting.
No, exactly. And what it helped to do is it helped us, you know, shape this productivity side of us, right? That's where coffee breaks came from is, you know, your industry wanted to give coffee breaks to get more productivity out of their workers. So they would give them like these times where they could be put in this state where they'd be more highly productive and elicit certain kind of cognitive function that helped to sort of create the framework for how people function and can have its pros, but can also have its cons where you end up in this sort of beta induced sort of rat race type of mind sometimes if you go too far in that direction. Kava offers something that I think that we need in the culture, a perspective, a state of mind, a state of being, an alternative to dangerous substances. It can help to shape a, you know, new forms of a social fabric that look like they do in the islands, where you see very, very high levels of psychological health and mental illness and low instances of depression in the places that have used it. In the islands, actually, you know, in these villages and in some of the more rural parts of the islands where the chief still has final say over everything, if there's a dispute among two parties in the village, even like a marital dispute or a dispute between, you know, two villages or something, the chief will force the two parties to sit down and settle it over kava. right? Because it's seen as that good of a strategy for conflict resolution and stuff as well.
Probably easier for them than MDMA too, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's tolerable. It's anyone can use it.
Yeah. So, yeah. Wow. That's crazy. It's just so cool how I mean, your story of being on random buying sprees and addicted to benzos and buying exotic animals and recreating your life to be Ace Ventura animal detective, and what Kava did for you is actually pretty cool. And, you know, just because I know people are going to be interested in getting their hands on some of your unique formulations, you've got basically like, you've got the tincture, which I think is available right now. You've got like these little shots. I keep them in the fridge. I actually like to dump the shot into a little bit of sparkling water. And then I also like doing some of these mixes that we've been talking about, like blending it with a little bit of coffee or MCT oil or ketones, etc. But basically what's available for people right now is they can get the from your True Kava website, and I'll link to it in the show notes. Folks, go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com/Kava podcast, is they can get like the little tincture and the shots, right? Like those are the two main things that you got available, like the oil and the shots.
It's so important because with our product line, we kind of have and this is Kava in general from you know, a traditional extraction standpoint. It has sort of a tiered sort of staggered spectrum of effects that are all relative to you know, concentration. And you know what I mean by that is that like there are like 200 different strains of kava, just like with cannabis. Some are more sort of heady, nootropic, entheogenic. Mm-hmm. Some are more heavy, sort of sedative. We wanted to create, and we wanted to keep it focused, you know, to avoid confusion, especially in the beginning. And so, you know, we created, you know, mixtures of strains that are really balanced, that don't, you know, put you to sleep and that are not overly activating at the same time, that sort of give that calm focus that allows for sort of the best, you know, effects profile that most people would be looking for. You know, to get this balance, this activated, calm, you know, sort of, you know, focus and engagement that people are looking for. So the oil, is our baseline product. And that is the one that's basically a good sort of entry point for people just getting into.
It's like a tincture. And there's two different strains, right? You have one that I noticed you've got one that you've marketed as a nootropic version. And then one that's kind of like the regular version. Is the difference between the regular and the nootropic just the strain that you use?
Yeah, exactly. So the strain that we use in the regular one, the main strain is called Barigu. And it's a really balanced strain that's sort of the broad spectrum effects of Kava. That's the core product. And the Kavaplex is actually pressed, you know, with a, you know, specific, you know, pressing method, you know, that, you know, gets, you know, the full spectrum of Kava lactones, but at a concentration that's more subtle than the drinks, right? Meaning that it gives effects that we wanted to be most versatile and tolerable at any time of the day for all ages, even kids, right? So we have kids taking, you know, the product, you know, for multiple, you know, applications. And that's a good entry level product that is almost kind of like an all purpose, like food. You can add it into, you can put it on salads, you can put it in your coffee, you can take it any time of the day with, and it's just so versatile and very, very smooth. The other oil is that same concentration, but just a different strain that's from Tonga. That is more sort of euphoric, more of that dopaminergic effect that we didn't really get to touch on, but that's where the actual engaged part of Kava comes from, that non-addictive, non-depletatory dopaminergic effect from the monoamine oxidase inhibition. So so those are the base products, and that's what a lot of people really, really you know, start with to kind of dip their toes in. The shot and the drink. The drink isn't released yet. It will be in the next, you know, 2 to 3 months. It'll be made available. And that's the one that we're going retail with. But the shot and the drink are the same product. It's just they're made at the shot concentration, and then, you know, there's more liquid in the drink. But they're the same product. The shot's just more concentrated into like almost what, you know, would equate to like a 5-hour energy shot, except for the calming effects of Kava and things. But it's gonna be that next tier. That's more of what you'd find off of like a more subtle dose of what you'd find at a Kava bar. More of the euphoric effects, more of the social enhancing, you know, effects that you get off of the shots and the drinks.
Okay.
And, you know, we wanted it to be at a concentration that's pretty controlled. You can continue to consume those for higher effects. So.
Okay. Cool. So, and then we've also got a discount code for people on these. It's BenGreenfieldFitness.com/TrueKava, TRUKava. Not with an E, just TRU, True Kava. And the code, I think it's Ben 10. Does that save like 10% for people?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Ben 10, yeah, 10% off.
So Ben 10, I'm serious. If you're listening, and try like combining it with some stuff like we talked about, and I'll try and put a few of the favorite recipes in the show notes. Or Cameron, if you have anything else you want me to add to the show notes, I will, as far as some cool kava recipes. And if you guys yourself have used kava and you're listening in, or you have your own tips to add, or the ways that you've found to really synergize or amplify the effects, feel free to drop into the comment section at bengreenfieldfitness.com/kava podcast, K-A-V-A podcast, and leave them over there. Cameron, it's so cool though that you figured out a way to get this out there and make it healthy for people. So I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing all this stuff with us. And again, if folks want to, if they have follow-up questions or anything like that, just go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/kava podcast and leave them there. And I'll link to some of the other stuff we've talked about too, like my previous interview with Dr. Pompa and the True Kava website and a whole lot more. So, Cameron, anything else you want to share just while I've got you on the call?
You just a quick kind of, you know, couple little notes here, because a lot of people ask about this, and there's so much to cover. I didn't totally finish the story of like my progression.
I know
we never
finished the whole story.
But it's totally fine, because I mean, people get the gist of it. But you know, basically, it was it allowed me to get safely off of benzodiazepines, right, in a very short amount of time with little to no withdrawal symptoms, which was miraculous. In a couple of months, normally it takes a year and a half, and it was miraculous for me. And then that opened me up to being able to tolerate all the other things, all the other therapies, and eventually get my health back. And so it really did come in as kind of, you know, a saving grace for me. And we get this question all the time about people who are withdrawing from drugs. Obviously, we can't make any recommendations or tell people to come off their medications. You have to consult your physician for that. But as an interesting anecdote, we've seen this clinically so much, and this is where a lot of the research is going, that and PTSD as well, because of the perspective kava, you know, puts you in that we talked about. It helps you over time to sort of get in this reflective state that allows you to reflect on past experiences from a place of complete calm limbic safety, which helps to rewire the brain over time. This is why the indigenous people always saw it as a psychological medicine. And a lot of the research is being looked at with PTSD as well, too. So, and I had both of those things. So those things were very powerful for me. We see those a lot clinically. And I'm really excited about, you know, it's kind of the ushering in of a lot of these plant medicines, right, into, you know, the sort of not only the biohacking sphere, but into, you know, the general public. And kava is one of those that I think, unlike some of the stronger ones like psilocybin, that everyone, including grandma, can even tolerate, you know. And so it's exciting for me that there are, you know, natural compounds, and then there are tools and strategies that work with the intelligence of the body that can be used in times that are so necessary. You know, that we need every strategy that we have against stress and trauma and toxicity. And so it's another one of these really powerful tools that I really see as being, you know, part of the future of this industry. So,
well, awesome. I'm super stoked about getting this out to people and making them aware of its existence. I just think it's really cool what you've done, and I'm super grateful for you adding a little thing to my pantry that's just made life just a bit better. So Cameron, thanks for coming on the show. And for all you listening in, again, show notes are going to be bengreenfieldfitness.com/kava podcast. And until next time, I'm Ben Greenfield, along with Cameron George, signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have an amazing week. In compliance with the FTC guidelines, please assume the following about links and posts on this site. Most of the links going to products are often affiliate links, of which I receive a small commission from sales of certain items, but the price is the same for you, and sometimes I even get to share a unique and somewhat significant discount with you. In some cases, I might also be an investor in a company I mention. I'm the founder, for example, of Keon LLC, the makers of Keon-branded supplements and products, which I talk about quite a bit. Regardless of the relationship, if I post or talk about an affiliate link to a product, it is indeed something I personally use, support, and with full authenticity and transparency, recommend in good conscience. I personally vet each and every product that I talk about. My first priority is providing valuable information and resources to you that help you positively optimize your mind, body, and spirit. And I'll only ever link to products or resources, affiliate or otherwise, that fit within this purpose. So there's your fancy legal disclaimer.